Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. The new Luther film debuted in about 500 theaters, 35 cities over the weekend. I had opportunity to see it Friday morning and then again on Saturday morning. On the second viewing, there were things that I noticed and, quite frankly, things that I appreciated more than on the first viewing. I think it's that way with any decent film. Someone says, is it a good movie? They ask that kind of question. Is it a good movie? In other words, yeah, the subject matter I'm sympathetic to, but will it hold my attention? Well, it held my attention on two separate screenings. What about, since it is a movie that deals with matters of history, what about its accuracy in matters historical? We'll get a general review from Dr. Ken Sherb here in this half hour, and we'll ask him to apply his doctorate in history in answering the questions surrounding how well history was portrayed and Luther himself as a man of history in the new Luther movie during this half hour. Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri, a former assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He served on the faculty of Concordia University in Ann Arbor, and he holds a doctorate in history from Ohio State University. Dr. Sherb, welcome back.
It's good to be with you as always, Todd. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Ken, your title sheet is almost as long as Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's.
Oh, come on now.
But you're still behind him. You're still behind him. Your general reaction to the Luther film?
I was quite favorably impressed on the whole. I saw it along with a group of, about 300 other people last Tuesday night at a theater in St. Louis. And I, on the whole, thought it was very well done. Now, you can nitpick it as far as historical accuracy is concerned. The biggest concern always in a film like this is, what are you going to leave out? You know, you can't portray anywhere near everything with respect to Luther in 2 hours. So one of the big questions is not so much what did you think of what you did see on the screen, but what did you not see that would have been good to have maybe seen?
Well, let's get into that in a minute, because I think the average moviegoer, even the one who's going to see this film because they're quite interested in the subject matter, Luther himself and the Reformation, probably is not aware of what got left out. They're probably getting more in this film than they ever knew of Luther in the first place. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, and that leads to an interesting point that one of the people in our group the other night made as we were all on the way out of the theater. And I think this is a point that should be made perhaps right at the start of our discussion. He said, you'd have to either be Lutheran or at least know a lot about Luther already in order to really have an appreciation of this film. Unlike the Martin Luther movie of 50 years ago, this one does not have any narration. There are not a lot of words on a screen. You may have like an establishing shot showing the city of Augsburg, and it'll say Augsburg, 1518 or something like that. But there's not a whole lot of cues, either visual or audio, to catch you up on what's going on. So I would suggest that people who are going to see the Luther movie bone up a bit before they go.
Now, let's talk, before we get into the historical content, about the gospel content in this movie. This was my overriding concern, because I thought, look, if you're going to make a movie about Luther, that's fine and good. But if it's going to be accurate to Luther's ethos, to his mind, to the driving force behind the man and the Reformation that he spawned, you will have to get the gospel right, and you'll have to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
Does this film do that in your estimation?
For the most part. Again, you could always look for some improvement. I'll tell you, the biggest thing that I am disappointed in this regard is that the movie approached this like a movie. That is, the producers like to deal in things that can be shown on the screen. And if you're not careful, you begin to think that Luther's whole debate with the Roman Church began and ended with the subject of indulgences, because indulgences, the selling of indulgences, the buying of indulgences, the behind-the-scenes politicking that led to the particular indulgence that John Tetzel was preaching at the time Luther posted his 95 Theses. And that's all the kind of thing that can be shown on the screen, dramatized and depicted for audiences. The fact that Luther's theological struggle was all wrapped up in what the righteousness of God was all about is not absent from this film, but it's not nearly as prominent as it could be. And the fact that the answer, in effect, to all of Luther's struggles came in the form of a alien righteousness imputed to him from outside of himself, the righteousness of Christ, which he is cloaked by faith, that could have been a point better made, although it's not certainly absent at all in this film.
Let's talk about it as a matter of history, walking through this, if we can, by memory, more or less kind of scene by scene. It begins with the famous vow to Saint Anne, if I'm not mistaken, the save me and I will become a monk scene, very quickly cutting to Luther in Erfurt as a monk. How do you judge the historicity of this particular treatment in the film, Luther?
Well, that's not too bad. The thunderstorm, which is where the film begins, and Luther's vow to become a monk, is very impressive and I think very close to all the accounts we have. And obviously, we don't have any contemporary accounts. Nobody was watching Luther. Nobody thought he'd be worth watching at the time, taking note of what he was doing out there in the thunderstorm. We really only have Luther's later recollections of this to go on. But very quickly, not only do you cut to the monastery in Erfurt, but you cut to Luther becoming a priest and celebrating his first Mass, which takes place 2 years later. Now, there is a good portion of that scene where Luther's father comes to observe, and I think that they play up a little bit the amount of nervousness that Luther had in celebrating his first Mass, just as, in fact, the film of 50 years ago did. But then when it's all over, it's looking like Luther's father is just leaving in disgust. In fact, by Luther's own accounting of it, his father stayed for the banquet that was customary to have right after a new priest celebrated his first Mass. And it's in that setting that Luther says something to his father like, and again, we know this because Luther remembers it later on, isn't it better this way? Isn't it better that I didn't become a lawyer? Now I can do so much more for you for eternity as a priest. And his father says, haven't you heard the commandment that says, honor your father and mother? Well, in the film, Luther's father says this to him from the horseback as he's riding out of town, not at the banquet.
But the father's displeasure, Luther's father's displeasure at Luther abandoning the study of law to become a monk is pretty accurate, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Remember, when Luther decided that he was going to go into that monastery, he had to divest himself of all of his possessions, including the big, fat, expensive law book that his father had just given him. He just gives it away.
All right, moving on then to the period of Luther's struggle with the indulgences. There are obviously some fictionalized interpolations in the film. The death of a suicide, which seems to serve in the story somewhat pivotally and to move along certain elements of the story. Luther at Wittenberg, how well does this movie treat Luther as both a preacher at Wittenberg and also a professor, a student and a professor at the university?
It's not bad. Of course, one of the things that happens up to that point is Luther's trip to Rome, which I think is depicted pretty well here. And then, right, Luther goes, first of all, to Wittenberg as preacher and student, studying for his doctorate, then as a professor, and I think the film does reasonably well there. Luther had a lot of hats he was wearing at the time, and the film at least hints at all these hats. I mean, he was preacher in the town church, and in that sense had pastoral responsibilities to the people. The people in the film are kind of all symbolized in one peasant woman and her crippled daughter. And I thought that that was a very nice device and on the whole done very well to show Luther's relationship to the common people. But yeah, he's preacher, he is professor, he is the sort of guide and counselor to lots of his young students, and this is all coming across, I think, very well in the film.
What do you make, this was just a pet peeve of mine, but they had Luther preaching kind of in the modern style of the contemporary church, walking in and amongst the pews of the church there in Wittenberg.
Yeah, like the people are sitting in pews. I mean, in Luther's time, people did not sit in pews.
What about the preacher preaching from outside the pulpit?
Well, how could he be seen if he were anywhere but in an elevated place? You've got a crowd that's standing around. So, yeah, you're right. That's a bit of 20th century or 21st century prejudice seeping in.
Or maybe just it makes a better cinematic picture to have him preaching the gospel among the people, kind of face-to-face with them. That was my eventual explanation I came up with.
Well, yeah, and if anything, the statement that it's being made with the camera shot is that Luther is among the people. He's not standing far off issuing dictates to them in the manner, say, of the Pope.
What about the entire, and this ties together with the trip to Rome, of course, what about the way the film depicted Luther and his treatment of the abuses of indulgences, in particular the preaching of indulgences by the emissary from the Pope?
It wasn't bad. I mean, remember, Luther's original concern was a pastoral concern. When Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door, he was not questioning indulgences, and he was not questioning the Pope's authority to issue indulgences. And that's something I think we very often forget when we think that the Luther who posted the 95 Theses in October of 1517 was the full-blown Luther who had thought all these things through. Now, Luther's concern at the time was for the way the common people were being misled by these indulgences. And I think that that is a point that's well made here. Again, using the image and the device of this woman and her crippled daughter.
And then Luther's trial before Cardinal Cajetan and the other, it very rapidly begins to snowball there back and forth on the issue of indulgences. What do you think?
I was happy to see that the trial, or hearing as it were, before Cajetan is one of the things the producers chose to kind of play up, because it really is worth consideration. Luther, by this time, has been tangling with some theologians, even some minor officials in Rome, but here is Cajetan, who is a papal legate, who is coming on the Pope's behalf to a diet in the city of Augsburg in 1518. Luther is summoned there. He doesn't realize it at the time, but his prince, Frederick the Wise, who I must say is the most delightful character in this film, played by Peter Ustinov, he doesn't realize that Frederick the Wise has already gotten, in effect, a safe conduct for him. He has secured from Cajetan the promise that Cajetan is not going to seize Luther. Now, again, you can't show everything that really happened in the scene as it occurred. Luther came back a second and a third day and appeared before Cajetan. And they had a lot of discussion. But what the film does show very effectively was that Cajetan allowed himself to get baited into having a discussion with Luther. That was not his assignment. Cajetan's assignment was to get Luther to say one word, revoco, I recant, I take it all back. But he didn't do that. In fact, he ends up getting frustrated, angry with Luther, and just dismissing him, saying, get out of my sight until you are ready to come back here and recant. And then, very true to historical fact, it is at that point that Luther's father confessor and superior in the Augustinian monastic order up to that point, Staupitz, releases Luther from his monastic vow and says, get on a horse and ride. Ride out of here before Cajetan changes his mind, before any soldier takes it into his mind that it would be kind of a feather in his cap to detain you. get on that horse and start riding. Now, what you don't find out is that Luther had to be snuck through a hole in the wall, not unlike St. Paul in the Book of Acts for this occasion. But yeah, he rides the horse. And the irony that could have been pointed out, when he makes it back to Wittenberg, having ridden that horse very hard, and he's virtually exhausted, what's the date? October 31st, 1518. 1 year to the day after the posting of the 95 Theses.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Sherb about the new Luther movie. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Larry is on the line, calling from Collinsville. Larry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, good afternoon. One of the things I really liked about the movie is that they depicted not just Luther the reformer and the national symbol and hero and figure, but Luther the pastor. I mean, this guy had a heart for his people. What do you think about that?
Thank you very much, Larry.
Absolutely. It comes across in a variety of ways, and I was quite taken with that, too, because I think that one of the things you have to remember about Luther's reforming work is that here is a man who is thinking always as a pastor. Yes, he's a professor. Yes, he's a theologian. Yes, he's a controversial figure. Yes, he's a kind of a celebrity, but he's always a pastor.
Now, moving on through the history of the film, when he arrives back in Wittenberg, 1518, how do you think the film deals with the transpiring events from this point on?
Well, again, it's a matter of selection. One very important point is the attempt on the part of the Pope to bribe, as it were, Elector Frederick of Saxony by sending him a token of papal approval called the Golden Rose. Again, the performance by Peter Ustinov is extremely winsome here, where he just sort of laughs and says, I'm amazed at how easily they thought they could bribe me. He recognizes what this is. It's a bribe because the emperor has died. Maximilian, emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, is no longer, and a new emperor has to be chosen. The Pope, in addition to trying to get Frederick the Wise's cooperation in the matter of Luther, is also trying to secure his cooperation in the election of a new Holy Roman Emperor. He does not want the young King of Spain, Charles, to be elected Holy Roman Emperor, and Frederick the Wise has one of the seven votes that is going to determine this. And, of course, at length, Charles does get elected. Charles, I think, is very well played in this film.
He's depicted as basically a teenager come man throughout most of this film.
A young man and one who doesn't really have a whole lot of patience with the intricacies of theology. He regards himself a son of the church. He recognizes that there are some hard realities of politics that he's got to face as the emperor. But no, I thought the depiction of Charles was very good.
Ken, would you be willing to stay with us for a few minutes after our bottom of the hour break? We've got people who are lining up to talk about the film, and we still have a ways to go in our historical critique of the film as well.
Yeah, but only a few. I don't think I can stay clear till 5.
All right, let's talk with Paul, who's calling from his car. Paul, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. This is Paul McCain. I just heard from the producer, the U.S. producer, Dennis Kloss, and they were actually disappointed with the first weekend's box office return. It dawned on me, maybe some pastors went to see it first and then they felt willing to recommend it to the congregation. But his warning is that if people don't get to see this film, don't get out to see the film next weekend, it may very well be gone from the theaters already by next week. So just a word, if people are going to see it, they better do it quickly. And here in the St. Louis area, the best place to see it is at Ronnie's Cine, the Ronnie's 20. Down off of South Lindbergh. They've got it in a great theater, and the sound system there is superb, and there's no problem understanding what the people are saying. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Paul, thank you very much. And thank you, by the way, Paul, as the CEO of Concordia Publishing House, was kind enough to donate for our KFUO screening a copy of Luther's works on CD-ROM, not only Luther's works, but the whole Book of Concord and also the King James Version Bible, all on a CD-ROM, and one of our listeners carried that away after our screening. Let's talk with Ty, calling from his car. Ty, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was curious, with the anti-Roman Catholic climate that's been going around here as of late, do you think that helped in getting this movie for a theatrical release? And I'm very much looking forward to see it, but haven't done so yet. I realize that you're Lutherans, but how villainous was the Roman Catholic Church portrayed in this picture?
That was another concern that I shared as well, along with Ty. What do you think, Ken?
Well, of course, the Pope doesn't come off the greatest in this movie. And I think that that would actually be the assessment of a lot of Roman Catholic historians today about Pope Leo X. I don't think, however, that this film is in any way provocatively anti-Roman. I was looking for that, too. And if it was there, it just kind of slipped under my radar. I just don't see it.
If anything, I perceived that there was rather sympathetic treatment, especially with regard to the Caiaphas character and others, that there was definitely reform needed in the Roman Catholic Church at the time. And they recognized this, even going so far as to agree with the concerns posted by the 95 Theses.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, some of the things that you don't see again, like in 1519, would be the Leipzig debate and Luther's final conclusion after his study leading up to that debate, that not only had popes, in fact, erred in the past, but so had councils, and some of the kind of vituperative language that Luther would then use in referring to the Pope. That's not here.
With 2 minutes before our break, a bit more history of the film. Next in the film is the events leading up to the famous hearing before the emperor, where the words spoken, "Here I stand," are on the film. How do you think those events were depicted in the Luther film?
Well, again, it's spotty, but on the whole, very impressive. And by the way, let's be very glad that they kept those words in there. There has been this crazy debate going on for a long time that Luther did not say those exact words, which, of course, were the words Roland Bainton took as the title of his famous biography of Luther, "Here I Stand." Luther, in his later years, had occasion to autograph a picture which depicted him making that statement at Worms, and he signs underneath, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Now, nobody had a tape recorder running at the Diet of Worms in April of 1521, obviously, but if there's anything that can make the point, it is that. Likewise, this film doesn't enter into the silly debate about whether Luther simply mailed the 95 Theses off as propositions for debate, or did he really nail them to the door of the church. It simply says he nailed them to the door, and as one professor is fond of saying, whether the Theses were nailed or mailed, in any case, they were posted.
Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest. We're talking about the new Luther movie. When we come back, he's been kind enough to agree to join us for at least a few minutes. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. As time permits, we will take your phone calls on the other side of the break with Dr. Ken Cherb, and then open lines follows for your phone calls free and clear. Stay with us.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, "The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology." The latest issue also contains articles titled, "The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart" by Pastor Eric Rotman, "Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos" by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay, "From Evangelicalism to the Evangel."
Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Detmer. The ACLU continues its relentless attack on God and the public square. This time, they're threatening to remove a Ten Commandments monument from a public park in Phoenix, Arizona. Concerned Christians rallied Saturday to defend the monument and the God who gave them. Steve Jordahl was there.
The sound of the Jewish shofar horn called the 500 people gathered under the hot Arizona sun to prayer.
Father in heaven, we gather today, Lord, and we ask for your mercy to be made known, Lord.
They came from all over the state, but with one goal. Gene Tierpak made the trip east.
Wickenburg is 60 miles going toward California. I'm here to uphold, not to move the monument, because it's our natural history and foundation for law. I can see
not with singing and dancing and a lot of prayer, the gathering wasn't as much a protest rally as it was a revival meeting.
The reason this is such an issue, the reason we're even having debate about writing the Ten Commandments on public buildings and monuments, is because God's people have not had his commandments written on our hearts. Amen. We need to repent.
I thought it was wonderfully inspiring, and we're really glad we came tonight.
Marsha Larson and her family left the rally with a renewed sense of resolve.
We learned that we all need to come together, and we need to show our faith and to live it so that everybody around us can see it.
Think of them as a walking Ten Commandments monument in their corner of the public square. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl in Phoenix.
The ACLU hasn't filed suit yet, but they have sent a letter to the state demanding that the monument be removed. Similar rallies are planned in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. A complete list of the Ten Commandment rallies can be found at StopJudicialTyranny.com. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Detmer.
Have you visited KFUO.org lately? It changes every day. Our website, www.kfuo.org, has new audio, sound bites, text, and links every day. So if you just have time for a short inspirational sound bite, an entire program on demand, or the live broadcast via streaming, visit us worldwide at kfuo.org. So tell your friends about us. Jot it down, send them an email. That's www.kfuo.org.
What does it mean that every believer is perfect in Christ? You can find out with the new Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this commentary at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes left with Ken Sherb as we talk about the new Luther movie. He's walking us through the history of this film. We'll have open lines after that for your questions and your comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then near the end of the program, around 5:30, Dr. James Hitchcock joins us, professor of history at St. Louis University. We'll be talking about the appointment of St. Louis Archbishop, now Archbishop in Philadelphia, Justin Regali, to be a cardinal this weekend. And then in the last 10 minutes or so, David Anderson of the American Anglican Council joins us to talk about the news that is coming out of the Diocese of Pennsylvania and Texas in the Episcopal Church USA. They have both voted to declare the action of the approval of Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA, to be outside the authority of the church. We'll also talk about an upcoming meeting in Texas of those who are disgruntled over that action on the part of the Episcopal Church USA. Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri, former assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He served on the faculty of Concordia University in Ann Arbor, and he holds a doctorate in history from Ohio State University. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Picking up on the history of the film, I'm going to ask you to treat Luther's flight, his kidnapping, then his translation of the New Testament and his return to Wittenberg to find Karlstadt up to no good, all in one fell swoop.
Well, once you hit the early 1520s, after Luther's great statement at Worms, you got to understand your foot is on a banana peel in this film, because it's going to slide real fast. And some events that were actually quite distinct in time are going to get treated as if they were all occurring simultaneously or in very rapid succession, and they weren't. As you note, Luther is kidnapped by the forces of Frederick the Wise on his way back from the Diet of Worms in April of 1521. He is spirited off to the Wartburg Castle. At first, he doesn't even know where he's going. And, you know, the film does, I think, a good job of picking up on Luther's surprise over what's going on here. He does there start writing several things, including his treatise on monastic vows, which doesn't get mentioned in the film. But probably the most prominent thing that he did is the thing the film does pick up on, and that is he takes it upon himself to translate the New Testament into German. When he gets antsy, there is the opportunity for him to go out if he's in disguise. Of course, he's let his hair grow now, so his tonsure is no longer showing. The film, I don't think, shows him with a beard, although at the time, contemporary artists depicted him with a beard. He was calling himself Knight George, and Knight George actually did get around a little bit. It looks like, however, Luther goes back as Knight George to Wittenberg, and there sort of does physical battle, almost, with the iconoclastic forces that have been raised up largely under the leadership of Karlstadt. What happened, of course, in fact, was Luther, after having been at the Wartburg for almost a year, in March of 1522, does go back, but he doesn't go back in disguise anymore. He ascends his old pulpit, and for a week he preaches to the people on what they have done and how they have run the risk of alienating people from the cause of the Reformation, the cause of Christ and the gospel. And, of course, those are famous sermons which have been translated into English. You can read those to this day. And I'm a little bit sorry we didn't get a portion of at least one of those sermons, as the 50-year-old Luther movie showed. So Luther gets back, and, yeah, he is concerned to quell what was called the Wittenberg disturbances.
Now, again, taking another big bite here, then, and this was one of the things that disturbed me a little bit, it almost, the film, because it compressed the events, almost depicted that Karlstadt's iconoclastic, you know, taking down all images and tearing robes off priests, was of one cloth, pardon the pun, with the peasants' war that followed, then the marriage of Luther and, of course, the presentation of the Augsburg Confession.
No, exactly. You begin to think that the Wittenberg disturbances were of one piece with the Peasants' War, and that's just not true. The Peasants' War, of course, erupted in 1525. And Luther, after having lent a sympathetic ear to some of the demands of the peasants, for example, their first demand was that they elect their own pastors, and Luther said that's perfectly appropriate. They have every right to want that. But he ended up taking a very dim view of the peasants because he took a very dim view of rebellion. And the amount of disturbance and the sheer carnage that the Peasants' War unleashed is shown in the film as being something that Luther very deeply regretted. I'm not so sure that he regretted it all that much, because he thought that this was necessary to quell an uprising. Of course, it was sad to see so many people die, but I don't think Luther regretted his role in advising the princes that they had to put down this rebellion.
And then there's a scene leading up to the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, kind of a little pep talk that Luther gives the German princes. But when they go into Augsburg to meet the emperor, and to meet the challenge of the emperor to recant their teachings and to prohibit the preaching of this so-called new gospel. How was that depicted?
Well, what the film is really trying to do is to depict some things that Luther wrote. The pep talk was a pep talk he issued more on paper than in oral speech, but of course that doesn't play too well on the screen, just to flash up what he wrote. So they have the actor portraying Luther kind of perform that. Of course, Luther did not go personally to Augsburg, and eventually you get that point, but I'm not sure, again, if you don't know that going in, I'm not sure you realize it right away in the film. And, of course, Luther knew exactly what was going on at Augsburg. He was getting letters from the delegation there. Of course, there was a little bit of delay before he would get a report from them, and so he didn't know the things that were happening as they were happening, but he knew in great detail. The way the film makes it look, it seems like a great surprise when somebody says, oh, we've presented our confession. They had been working for weeks to try to present their confession.
This leads me to one last brief question, and that is, the character that I know is so near and dear to your heart of the time of the Reformation is Philip Melanchthon, and he, for some reason, is reduced to a rather small role in this film. Your assessment of what they did depict of this giant in the Reformation?
Well, at first, you don't even know which one he is. I mean, there's a couple of scenes where it becomes pretty apparent this has got to be Melanchthon there at Augsburg with the princes, for example. But for the most part, no, you don't even know who Melanchthon was. And, of course, there are lots of other things. Zwingli makes no appearance here. Luther's whole debate with Zwingli at Marburg the year before the Augsburg Confession, the whole sacramentarian controversy is just not there. The idea that Luther was fighting on another front besides Rome, which is a historical fact of some moment, is just not really even taken up here.
Let's talk with a couple more listeners here. First, Ken is calling from Pittsburgh, listening on the Internet. Ken, you've been patient. Thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues, etc.
Thank you. I guess while listening, you've prompted a second question from me. You said that before you go to see the movie, which I do plan on doing, I was down with the flu this weekend, or I would have seen it on Saturday or Sunday, but I will go either one evening this week or this coming week. It's only playing at two theaters here in Pittsburgh, three that I know of. And what would your recommendation, even after I've seen the movie, would be your recommendation on a good biography of Martin Luther?
It's an excellent question. Ken, your response?
Well, you know what I'm going to say. Luther the Reformer by Jim Kittelsen, published by Augsburg. It is the best one-volume biography, also as an entry-level biography in the English language on Luther.
And I would recommend one other thing. This actually will be our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October. It's called Lift High This Cross. It is a book that treats, by way of kind of biography and excerpting Luther's major writings of the time, the very period that's covered by this book, from the 95 Theses to the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, and it is a good kind of thumbnail sketch by way of Luther's major writings during this time. The book is called Lift High This Cross. It's going to be our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October. It can be purchased through Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. You can also go online to their website, cph.org. Lift High This Cross. It's tremendous. Kind of a good handbook for these things, for those who are interested more than just in the history, but also in Luther's writings there as well.
Well, and may I say, Todd, I think that's an excellent resource. I have not actually seen the book yet. I've seen its cover is all. But I'm sure that I know the author, and I know the kind of Luther scholarship he did before he died, and I'm sure it would be a great book for your listeners.
Finally, Ken, why should our listeners see Luther this week?
Well, Luther was rated by, I think, the Biography Channel or somebody who did the rating right before the year 2000 dawned as one of, like, the most influential people. I think he was, like, the third most influential person in their estimation for the last 1,000 years. And I think that it's hard to argue with that, whether you think of Luther primarily as a theologian or whether you think of him primarily as a figure politics or a figure whose work at least had political implications, a linguist, a musician. He is an important person in any number of fields. But, of course, especially for those who have studied, for example, Luther's Catechism or who have subscribed to the Augsburg Confession, it always helps us to know the history behind those documents and why things were said the way they were said at the time of the Reformation. Certainly, that's not the only words in which the doctrine of the gospel can be expressed, but having an idea of why they were said in just this way at that time is extremely valuable.
Dr. Ken Sherb, thank you for your time, giving us your extra time, and being our guest on Issues, Etc.
It's always a pleasure, Todd. Thank you for asking me.
Dr. Ken Sherb, pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri, former assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, former faculty member of Concordia University in Ann Arbor, and also holding a doctorate in history from Ohio State University. It's open lines for the next 45 minutes, the next 15 minutes of this hour, and the next half hour in the third hour of Issues, Etc. I'm looking for your review of the new Luther movie. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If time permits, I'll also share, at least in substance, the review that was written by Chris Armstrong, managing editor of Christian History Magazine and a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., of the film as well. He takes exception with some things, and of course he has a little bit of praise as well. Anne is calling from Crestwood. Anne, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, hi. I was so excited about this movie after I saw it Saturday, Pastor, that I emailed everybody in my address book and told them I would pay for them to go see this. Please go see it. And a couple things. There was a scene where the people were kneeling on steps, tons of people to, earn their, doing their works to get their time out of purgatory. That was particularly moving to me. And I thought that might make a strong statement to the Roman Catholic Church, which they still do believe in indulgences, because as a little girl I said the indulgences in the 50s and the 60s, said certain prayers to earn indulgences. And the other thing I wanted to say, I thought there was a sharp contrast, and I was wondering about it, in the how filthy the people were. Their hair, they were toothless. It looked like they didn't bathe, and I think people then maybe they bathed once a year because of superstition. But next to the monks who were clean and had their teeth, was that a Hollywood thing? And I don't know if you can answer.
Well, I can do my best to answer it. First of all, you're right, that one scene, quite moving in the film, where Luther, on his visit to Rome, he's been sent there to deliver a legal brief as a member and one of the bright shining stars of the Augustinian Order in Erfurt. He's sent there by his father confessor, Staupitz. I think the film does a good job of depicting why he is sent. I think Staupitz does understand that Luther's trip to Rome will show him things of his church that that will disturb him. And now that's going into his motivation. However, when Luther gets there, he sees people buying indulgences, and then by way of fulfilling this indulgence, they're to climb the steps on their knees, praying an Our Father at each step in order, when they get to the top, to release themselves or a loved one from time in purgatory. Very accurate, not only in what was actually being practiced on pilgrimages to Rome, but also very accurate in terms of what was being taught about indulgences popularly and what the people were believing. They were believing that these edicts from the Pope or from bishops could release from purgatory. And the reality of purgatory was one that permeated the life of the pious during this time before the Reformation. Now, as to the hygienic conditions, I think it's pretty accurate. I mean, the average person, the reason you didn't bathe was not because you didn't think bathing was a good idea, but because you were living in northern Germany, and part of the year, bathing probably would have meant your death by pneumonia. And the average person is literally living hand to mouth. Now, they might have smudged them up a little too much. I think people, they would have been toothless, no doubt. You know, we need to remember this about the biblical times, too. The apostles might have also been toothless. They lived in an even more primitive time than that of 16th century. Now, as to the monks being well-groomed and things like that, that's pretty accurate. There's a huge gap between the nobility and the average person, the peasantry. And there's a huge gap between the professional classes, if you will, at the very peak of medieval professional classes are the clergy and the peasantry. So I think that was pretty accurate. Nice observation on the part of Anne there. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dwight is calling from his car. Dwight, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
I haven't seen the movie Luther yet, but I do want to see it. But my question is about another movie, and that is I'm hearing rumors that in talking about the movie Passion, that Hollywood is trying to stop it from being published. That the person that owns the rights to it is, or would that normally would publish it, has refused to publish it because of the anti-Semitic notion that they have about the movie.
The story on this, as best as I know it, and I've been following this for, golly, this movie has been in the works for almost 2 years, that people knew about. And if Mel Gibson is actually the famous actor who is spearheading the production of this film. He doesn't appear in the film, but he has essentially been in complete control and put not a small amount of his own personal fortune into the production of the film as well. It does not yet have a distributor. That's part of the problem. The film is, as far as everyone knows, ready to go to theaters, but they're having a very hard time finding a distributor. So it's not that the distributor is refusing to put it out. I think Gibson actually owns the rights. He has his own production company, Icon Productions, that produced this. So he owns the film and its rights, but he needs to find someone who's willing to put it into theaters and put in the investment to get it out there. It will get distributed because this is a guaranteed box office draw, if only because of its notoriety. It will find a distributor. Now, who that will be, don't know. The controversy over whether or not it is anti-Semitic or whether it will spark anti-Semitism, I think, is probably going to be with us well after the movie The Passion is released. I'll say this much. If it accurately and faithfully depicts the last 12 hours of Jesus' life before his crucifixion and resurrection, according to the gospel, I think it's using the Gospel of John as its basic script. If it does that accurately, there's no reasonable call to accuse it of being anti-Semitic, because we're simply dealing with matters of history there. And if it's a fact, it's a fact. Facts are not either anti-Semitic or not anti-Semitic. They are simply facts of history. Now, there's a movie people are looking forward to seeing. Linda is calling from Nashville. Linda, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Okay, simply question. Hear me?
Yes, I can.
I was wondering what your opinion was concerning, one is Martin Luther by Edwin Booth, published by Barber Publishing Company, and the other one is This is Luther by Ewald, Ploss, published by Concordia.
Linda, thank you very much. I cannot claim to be familiar with the first one. This is Luther. I have on my shelf, but I don't remember enough about reading it to give you an accurate picture. The one that was mentioned by Ken, I have read recently, well, within the last 5 years, called Luther the Reformer by Kittleson. And it is a good one-volume treatment of Luther. A very good one-volume treatment. Think about it. I have a biography of Thomas Jefferson at home that is 7 or 8 volumes. Big books, little print. Now, that is the life of one of the most significant figures of history in American history. Luther is as big, certainly bigger than Thomas Jefferson. And to pack it all into one volume is a massive undertaking anyway. And to do it in a faithful and accurate way is also a massive undertaking in itself. That would be my recommendation. My recommendation, aside from the other ones mentioned by Linda, would be Luther the Reformer. Roland Baton, Here I Stand, is good, although it can tend to be a bit heroic. And that's my biggest concern about biographies, is that we don't make people larger than life. By the way, Ken Sherb's doctoral advisor at Ohio State University was none other than Dr. James Kittleson, the author of Luther the Reformer. So by way of scholarship, I think Ken knows whereof he speaks there. But as to the Edwald Plass one, I don't remember enough about what I've read of it. It's sitting on my shelf, along with a bunch of other Luther biographies. It's sitting on my shelf. But I don't remember enough to speak with any authority on it. Give me a call during this break. We've got open lines for a half hour on the other side, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Your review of the new Luther movie, have you seen it? If you haven't seen it, what are you hoping to see the most out of this? I had someone stop me after the film on Saturday, someone who was educated in kind of a non-Lutheran and Christian background, and he said he would have liked to have seen a few things that weren't in there. He was coming from a perspective of, you know, I would have liked to have seen this and that and the other thing. He had a few questions. What about you? What are you hoping to see in this Luther film? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And if you've seen the 1953 classic, Martin Luther, how do you think it compares? The black and white one I'm talking about. How do you think the new one compares if you've seen both? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Chris Armstrong, who is managing editor for Christian History Magazine, has seen the film. He's a regular guest here on Issues Etc., by the way. He has some criticisms as to how Luther is depicted. And actually, before I read, not to get swept around by people's opinions too much, but before I read his assessment of the film, someone would have said, how do you think it depicts Luther? I would have said, very well. Shows a man kind of on the verge of insanity at times. I think that's accurate. Shows a man deeply ambivalent early on about what's going on. A man who even later has a very healthy dose of self-doubt at work in his life. Well, Chris Armstrong says one of the problems he finds with the movie is the relentless niceness of Luther in the film. He says Luther's just too nice. And he doesn't know if that stacks up against this hard-edged figure of history, Martin Luther. He also says that over against the void left by the old corrupted symbols of the late medieval Catholicism, the simple Jesus loves me theology of the film doesn't stack up either. We'll talk about that when we come back. 30 minutes of open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.